I won't say too much by way of introduction, but Cesare Cutiga is an Italian historian who studied in DDSPHA in Florence and has taught at the University of done research at the University of Sussex and is still partly associated with them, but is now a lecturer of early modern British history or British history at Paris Hint. So he's going to speak to us today, I think, partly about work that he has coming out very soon and explain a bit more how that fits into his larger ideas. So I'll let you know.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, thank you very much to Rosa for his invitation. Thanks to Stephen for very nice chat and small interview. And thanks to you for coming out tonight. Now, what should I say? Well, a few weeks ago I was invited, or dragged, to a Buddhist philosophy kum meditation lecture. And there, amongst many things I learned, that when you go to a conference or to a talk and you are bored, it's not the speaker's fault, but it's your fault. Now, because I don't want to, since I don't want to verify whether that is true or not, I decided to do two things. One is a, in order to keep you, you know, your attention up, is some sort of a form of shameless self-promotion. So I'm going to, so at least if you drop, you know, you've got a book, you know, you feel better responsive for. So I'm going to kind of circulate my letters, if you like, publication, using the other kind of work that I pursue. The second thing is, what I'm going to do in the next 40, 45 minutes is to have a chat about my monograph, which is coming out in, this year with MUP, Manchester University Press, on Robert Filmer. But what I'm going to do before telling who Robert Filmer was is to highlight three, 4 points for discussion, more kind of general, even of a mythological nature, so that we can have then a debate. Well, first of all, you have the handout, which is not really a handout, it's a table of contents, so just to show you what you know, book is like, or you know, the chapters are like. Filmer was a... born in 1588, he died in 1653. He's mainly notorious, that's hence the word villain in the title, notorious for having written a book called Patriarcha, so for being a defender of the idea of absolute monarchy, and also notorious for being a big loser. A big loser with a capital L, because he was attacked vehemently by John Locke and Algernon Sidney and James Tyrrell at the end of the 17th century. Now, you might say, why at the end of the 17th century if he died in 53? Well, because Patriarcha, his main book, and the book on which I focus in my work, only, and for the first time, came out in 1680. So, in other terms, my interest for Filmer stemmed from the fact that, you know, you might find his name and mainly criticised, but mainly read through the eyes of these people who criticised him at the end of the 17th century. Now, this being said, what I like here to what I'd like to do here is to raise, first of all, a mythological aspect. So, which partly I already mentioned, and that has to do with the so-called issue of the canon. What is a major author, a major thinker? What gives the status of major thinker or a minor figure to a author? And do we have the right to work on minor figures? I suppose yes. What do we do with them? So that's one big, I suppose, issue. The second one is my book an intellectual biography or not? What is an intellectual biography? Well, I can tell you in a way it's not a fully-fledged or complete intellectual biography, because that would have required you know, twice the time that I employed in writing this, but it's an intellectual biography not so much of a main filmer, but of a book, Patriarcha. So my book is a delineation, an intellectual biography, is a tracing of an intellectual trajectory of a book, when the book was written and when it was published. Hence, again, another mythological problem. What do we do as historians, as scholars, when we focus on the context in which something was produced and a quite different context in which something was then published? I suppose we could say that we have the problem of the authorial aspect of something, of a book, and the problem of the reception of the very same book. Now, the third sort of point in terms of, again, mythology is I am a historian of political thought. My approach was very much that of intellectual history. I suppose nobody's perfect. The focus is very much on the analysis of texts in relation to their context. So again, this is the third point. What do we do? How do we connect a text? And especially if you think, as I do, that texts are produced within frameworks of ideas, frameworks of traditions of thought, where certain tropes, certain languages, certain paradigms were used. So what do we know with them when text replies to text? How do we connect what they say with the context in which they said those things? How do we connect, in other terms, ideas and actions? Dialogues within the Republic of Letters and factual events, whether it's the death of a king, or a parliamentary act, or a battle, and so on and so forth. So these are, you know, in a kind of general way, some of the points that I like to raise in a more general nature. Now, when I said Filmer was a loser, well, of course, he did not usher in a winning theory of political thought. It was, to use the language of TV series like The Wire, was whacked by John Locke, who is considered to be one of the founding fathers, wrongly so, of the liberal tradition. But contemporary 20th century historiography did not change much its opinion of and on Filmer. In fact, for instance, if you look at the famous scholar G.D.A. Cole, he simply said with laconic beauty, Patriarcha is a silly book. So you might say, why working on a silly book? Well, I leave that to the shrink. But I thought that the importance of working on this book was that he has been read out of context. Again, always in relation to the Lockean criticism, or as a bunch of ideas which were superseded, replaced, defeated in the course of history. So the question that I wanted to ask is, so why? When was this book written? What did it mean to the people, to the audience that the book was trying to address? And an answer, as often, I suppose, in our work, came out when I was still too young, but I was lucky enough that nobody looked at it. And the answer was some the Trumbull papers in the British Library, where a manuscript note came out in which it was Filmer, Sir Robert Filmer, had asked permission to publish Patriarcha in 1632. The book was always, as I said at the beginning, was always thought to be, it was published in 1680, but it was thought to have been written during the Civil War in the 40s. And yet, we know that the book was ready in the late 20s. So this changes in a kind of ironic way, we can say, like Peter Maslett's work on John Locke, on the two treatises, They were not a revolutionary tract. They were written earlier. They were an exclusion tract. So, in a way, I try to apply the same reasoning. What does it mean that Filmer was writing at least 20 years, 15, 20 years? It's also been proved that parts of the book were written during the Oath of Allegiance crisis, so during the Jacobean period. So I started looking at the language of the treaties, and I tried to investigate what Filmer was referring to. For instance, when he talks at the very beginning of the book about these new coins, these are his words, new coin distinction between royalists and patriots. Who were these patriots? So I started looking into who these patriots might have been, and of course in the last few years I've been helped, if you like, by the work of other historians, Richard Cust from Birmingham University being one, and in trying to identify who these patriots were. So that was one first chunk of work I had to do, and that actually is what you find as chapter two. Of course, I'm not going to spend an awful lot of time on the biographical chapter, chapter one, in which I showed that Filmer was not a sort of backwoodsman from Kent with no sophisticated interest and just a simple patriarchal gentleman, landowner, and so on and so forth. No, I showed that his milieu was very much vibrant, and it was somebody who was interested in the major topics occupying the minds of the Republic of Letters, from witchcraft to usury, from manuals on the household and the situation or condition of women and wives, to issues of theology and, of course, politics. So having done that type of research in the first chapter, I moved on and I started analysing the work. And what I did in chapter two was to try and identify these patriots. And what comes out is that the patriots were people who often were in Parliament, MPs, who, between the late Jacobean phase, so we are in the James reign between 1603 and 1625, and the early Caroline period, 1625, through the personal rule up to the Civil War, the patriots were people who claimed the importance and the actual primary importance, I should say, of the country versus the king. So in other terms, their insistence was on the so-called liberties and rights of the free-born Englishmen. Their targets being the foreign, especially Spanish and French, policies and also mores and customs of the court. Let's not forget that Charles I was accused of being an Armenian, i.e. crypto-Catholic. He was married to a French woman, Henrietta Maria, and taste at court was very much European. So the patriots are, they are not a, I wouldn't like to give you the impression they were a ideologically uniform cluster, but in general we can say that their attraction was towards a country where Parliament had a larger, a bigger role, where attention was given to the subjects' liberties and rights, where the country occupied centre stage in their rhetoric, where, of course, a strong and steadfast opposition to the royal prerogative of the king was another important element, where the idea was that a good patriot was a good Protestant, was a good, what Richard Cust recently called, a good public man, somebody whose probity, integrity, and value were quintessentially in stark contrast to the idea of the courtesan, of effeminate and foreign looking in his trappings. One key example of this is the Duke of Buckingham. Duke of Buckingham was the great eminence of the Stuarts' reign, both with James and then with Charles. So, having, of course, because I don't want to inflict upon you too much, and I have to try and complete the journey here. So, the first thing to bear in mind is the patriots. Patriots, who they are, what they represent. And amongst them, I singled out one of Filmer's cousins from Kent as one of the most vocal mouthpieces of this cluster of more or less uniform cluster of ideological cluster, and is somebody called Thomas Scott of Canterbury, not to be confused with the most famous or more famous pamphleteer Thomas Scott of All for a Vox Populi. Now, the second big target that we see mentioned in Petrarca is the Jesuits. Now, this should not surprise anybody, especially in Protestant countries, because the Jesuits were the quintessential targets for many Protestant authors, above all for monarchical supporters, for two reasons. The first reason is because Jesuitite Cardinal Robert Bellarmine and Francisco Suarez believed in the popular origin of power, and secondly, believe in the indirect power of the Pope over national sovereigns. In other terms, according to them, the Pope had authority in the temporal sphere. So, patriots and Jesuits. Why? Patriots and Jesuits are the answer to why Robert Filmer decided to use the language of patriarchalism, and I'm going to tell you exactly what patriarchalism is in a second. That is why Filmer used the language of patriarchalism in the late 20s to counterattack what he perceived, perhaps in a distorted manner, certainly what he perceived as two threats to the integrity of an already struggling monarchical entity, of an already struggling monarchical government. First, the late phases of James' reign, and then the first phases of Charles' reign. To give you a couple of references to events, James had died in 1625, and there were rumours that he had been poisoned by the Duke of Buckingham with the aid of his son, Charles I. Now, you can definitely understand that this is not a good rumour to have circulating, because, certainly for many reasons, not good to the monarchy, but it's also not good to the idea that a king is the father of the country when actually as a son he is suspected of having killed his biological father. It's also a phase of increasing tension between Parliament, again, bear in mind the patriots here, and the king on many issues. The false law of 1626-27 and the petitioner right of 1628 are the two most emerging, most important features of these phases. So we are in what historians called a Caroline crisis. Charles I decided to embark on an 11-year personal rule from 1629 to 1640, meaning that he did not summon Parliament for 11 years, and he embarked upon what is considered to be a much absolutist phase. So this is to give you some coordinates in a kind of general map of the late Jacobean, early Caroline period. So the question here is, okay, why is Filmer resorting to the language of patriarchalism? He said to counterattack patriots and Jesuits. Counterattack what? Well, counterattack the fact that both patriots and the Jesuits were a threat, according to people like Filmer, because they were diverting the allegiance of the people diverting the allegiance of the subject from the monarch towards a different, if you like, agent, or a different agency of allegiance. In the case of the patriots, that was Parliament. The idea that Parliament was the kernel of the identity of the nation, and Parliament was the place where the liberties and the rights of the subject, the free-born, freeholders, could be protected. The Jesuits were diverting the allegiance of subjects from the national monarch towards the Pope, because the primary allegiance of the Jesuits in works is always the Pope, who is in Rome, who is a sort of supranational monarch. So the answer to these two languages, to these two political paradigms that Filmer chooses to adopt is patriarchalism. Why patriarchalism? And here we pause for a second, because we haven't defined what patriarchalism is. Now, we could spend an entire day talking about patriarchalism, above all because we can refer to the different fields in which patriarchalism is used or interpreted. In the economic sphere, patriarchalism is a system whereby in the early modern period the household was managed, was run. If you look at feminist theory, of course, we look at a society in archaic, generally society or system of a social system where the male, whether husband or father or elder brother, dominates, and where women, wives, or masters and servants are in a position of power and submission, respectively. But if we look at the political sphere, the idea is that Adam, as progenitor of humankind, was given direct power by God, and through the biblical patriarchs, power was then transmitted to kings. Hence, kings having a divine right, power over their subjects. And hence, as well, the analogy between kings and fathers, subjects and son. So this is what patriarchalism, in a kind of, you know, grand scheme of things, is. And yet, my reading of Filmer and reading of other sources, contemporary to Filmer, led me to think that what lots of historians, and here I quote people whose work is definitely still very much compelling, people like Gordon Shokett, James Daly, my mentor Johan Somerville, all these people did an amazing work, an amazing series of researches on patriarchies, but somehow what I found missing was the political aspect of patriarchies. In other terms, the fact that patriarchies was not just a societal theory, but it was also a political language adopted to counterattack alternative political languages, in this case, language of the patriots and the language of the Jesuits. So what does this political, what I take the liberty to call, to identify with the category of political patriarchies, refer to? Well, it's the idea that the kings are not just absolute because they are endowed with power by God, but there is something which has, so they are not just princeps because of their divine endowments, but they also, the other key word is they are at the principium. They are the first. Being the heirs of Adam, they are the creator, in other terms, of the political community. They are the founders of the state. And through the hereditary system, they are the bearers, if you like, of a continuous line, political line, which goes from the first human, Adam, stretched out down to the 17th century.
doesn't necessarily mean that people thought that they were the actual science of Adam, but the idea was that there was, they represented this tight continuity between the genetic, and there is a clear genetic element in this kind of pre-biblical patriarchalism, whereby the kings were the preservers of an order and of a continuity of stability, which, of a cohesiveness, if you like, which went from Adam on. In other terms, patriarchalism rejected the idea that the state of nature in which men are originally free could exist. In fact, for them it was absurd to conceive such a sort of gap between Adam and the creation of the society. Adam was the first politician, in a way, for patriarchies. So the idea that the king, the Adamite king, is the founder of the state, then transposes onto the political sphere, onto the method of government, which for patriarchalists is that the king is legibus solutus, in other terms, is loosened, is free of the control of the law, because he is lex loquens, he is the speaking law of the country, he is the creator of the law. So what the political energy of patriarchalism does is, in terms of the origins of power, is to, you know, reject all the ideas of contracts being the source of a society, and also it's this idea that the Adamite king is the founder of the state. In fact, he's not just the creator of the laws, but he's the creator of customs. And in that sense, he's the preserver of the ethos of the country. The second key aspect to understand what Filmer did is that for patriarchalists, and for many people in a way, but for patriarchalists in particular, the king is father of the family, pater patriae. Now, that was a common trope, a traditional way of describing a kingship. But the question that I thought worth asking was, why? Why did people like Filmer and others with it use that expression, that phrase, father of the fatherland, at a certain time, in a certain context, to attack who? And the answer is that, and the answer is an answer which has to do with the context in which Filmer wrote and the context in which it was published. So, to go sort of full circle, when I said that this book is very much an intellectual biography of a text rather than of a man, what I meant is that we can, and Peter de Martinis is not here because I did rely a lot on his work, the idea is that patriarcha, in a way, serves as a threat to lead us into the study of early modern or 17th century England, in this sense, because it shows how the problems, the issues at stake in the first part of the century end in the 1680s, in that terms, at the time of the exclusion crisis, at the time of the problems related to the succession to the throne of James II, who was Catholic, are the same. The languages, the metaphors used to describe power are very much the same. And amongst it, so patriarchy, in a way, serves to explain how two key, and simplified, of course, reasons due to time. So what I'm trying here to say is that patriarchy shows us how two key languages of the 17th century are patriotism and patriarchals. People, in other terms, the battle between, within, you know, the battle between different types of political ideas and governments were very much focused on the idea of who was the true representative of the country. For the patriots, it was parliament. For the patriarchies, it was a certain type of king. Now, we find the same types of accusations being laid at the door of, you know, each other's adversaries, both in the first part of the century and in the late part of the century. Therefore, that explains why Petrarca was republished for the first time. The book was refused the license to be published in 1632. The reasons for that are difficult to ascertain with certainty. Historians generally, the few who looked at the issue since the Trumbull Papers came out, tend to say, well, you know, it was a very extreme piece of absolutist doctrine. Hence, it was refused at the time when Charles had already enough travels. However, despite agreeing partly with that interpretation, I also think that it's too simple an explanation. And this is also kind of another part of my work. I made use of Kevin Sharp's work to try and understand whether Petrarca could have suited the type of aesthetic. When I say aesthetic, I mean visual. I did some work on Van Dyck and tried to connect Anthony Van Dyck's paintings and representations of Charles I and Filmer. So the aesthetic aspects, the cultural taste, the image construction process that the monarchy was trying to build up at that time. And I came up with perhaps tentative conclusion that, in a way, Filmer's Petrarca did not suit that canvas, in the sense that he proposed an image of the king as father, but not as husband. At a time when Charles was trying to depict himself as the good husband with Henrietta Maria. If you look at the paintings of that time, you do see that very clearly. The other thing which I embrace is that, as you know, the both James and Charles had what were defined as sort of like, especially James, Rex Pacificus. So both were accused by many in Protestant quarters in England to be too little bellicose and to be too pacifying. They had not intervened to help Elizabeth, James' daughter, in the Palatinate. So in other terms, they were not good promoters of the Protestant cause at home nor abroad. In fact, the hero for many Protestants in England in the first half, until the 30s, was a Swedish king, Gustavus Adolphus. So, in other sense, again, I apologize for not being probably accurate enough in describing what I've done, but time is, again, set limited. What I tried to do was to connect Petrarca and its message, not just to other political theories, but also to the climate, to the cultural, to the intellectual climate of the years in which it was published, to see why it was refused publication. And of course that brings to the question of why instead it was published in 1680, almost 30 years after the author's death. And the answer, thanks to the work of people like Jonathan Scott and Mark Knights, is that, again, this idea that the country is split between martyrs and traitors, between royalists and patriots, came to the fore again in the issue of the succession of James II, the problematic succession of James II, is prominent in this case. Now, the reason for publishing Petrarca is because Petrarca offers a message of stability due to the Adamites, the patriarchalist paradigm, whereby the king is the best governor, because it's the father of the fatherland. He is the one who can really protect the land. Okay, and this, you know, this is why I said at the beginning we need to think in terms of what happens in books, simplistically speaking, and what happens in reality. So, in a way, you know, what Filmer was saying might not correspond to what the reality was, but we need to ask ourselves what were authors doing when they're using certain paradigms, certain language, certain metaphors to describe power. What Filmer was doing was trying to depict the king as the best not, you know, Fiona was not a kind of hagiographic advocate of the Stuart. Probably, it's quite likely they didn't maybe even like them. But his ideal was one whereby the king, by being father, not the fatherland, is the best protector of the country. Because a father is always a father. A father would not let his offspring abandon. Would always, Phil says, feed, clothe, look after his offspring. Hence, a king would do exactly the same with his subjects. Whereas a parliament, being all the time subject to constant elections and friction, would prove to be a too unstable entity to be able to protect the country, especially at a time of crisis like the 20s and the 80s. Now, so in identifying, when using Petrarca as the sort of key, as the kind of verger, if you like, throughout the texture of 17th century England, I became convinced, and of course here, I can claim some originality, but I can also say very candidly that there are other scholars agreeing here, it's this idea that a stronger importance should be given to the kind of national identity, national consciousness element in 17th century India. In other terms, nationhood had much more value, much more importance to people, to writers, to the monarchy, to parliament, than has often been recognised. In Petrarca, both in terms of when it was written and in terms of when it was published, would prove that. Now, of course, the battle, was conducted on many fronts. If you were a patriarchalist, you would oppose, often you would oppose the idea of the common law. If you think that the king is less loquacious than speaking law of the country, you think that the law, which is actually something that Hobbes says as well, no patriarchalist at all. But Hobbes said, we need to have clarity. The law has to be certain. It has to be an authorial voice which is productive, but creative of the law. Now, the common law was attacked for being immemorial. That is to say, for not having a clear, we could say almost like, Cartesian-like clarity in terms of origins. It also means that the will of the sovereign, the will of the Adamite king, becomes extremely important, especially when it comes to solving problems due to the rigidity of the law. The king, in being above the law, would act as a good father by taming, by appeasing, in some cases, the rigidity of the law. And by appeasing the rigidity of the law, the king resolves to be more just than an impersonal entity such as a parliament. The battle, so I'm kind of illustrating before concluding the various fronts on which the battle between these two opposite camps was pursued. Another one is the important allegiance throughout the 17th century, the important issue throughout the 17th century of the allegiance versus the trust to either the king or parliament. If you think about John Locke, trust is a fundamental term in John Locke's treatise. Whereas patriarchalists tended to use the word allegiance, again, to signify that allegiance has got a more personal and personalised connotation, whereas trust reflects a more legalistic vocabulary whereby there is something more impersonal, which is what then you know, succeed in then the 18th century and on. Now, all this, you know, discourse on film and patriarcha, which of course has been also accompanied by a fully biographical attempt to situate, locate the men and think in this context. You know, again, as I said, if you read lots of work on film, especially prior to the 70s, with the exception of Peter Lazar, but even Peter Lazar sometimes had a little bit what some would call the syndrome of the social historian, tell me where you come from, where you are, who you are socially, and I'll tell you what your ideas would be like. Now, I know I feel a bit like swearing in church here, but the especially prior to the 70s, Filmer was also considered to be very much the villain, the silly writer whose ideas were stillborn already at his time. What else before? Time-wise, I'm good, I'm going to start with 5 past. Yes. So again, to perhaps stimulate. Okay, one last thing on this issue of patriarchalism and patriotism as two key languages through which we should look at the 17th century. The other key idea is the idea of parasite, parasite in French. We shouldn't forget that in 1589 and 1610, two French kings were murdered by rabid Jesuits. In 1605, there is the Gunpowder Plot. So kings can, and Charles I, of course, loses his head in 1649. So there is very much, monarchies were very much aware of the fact that actions could, or allegedly patriotic actions, could very much turn into murderous actions. And one of the, we can, in terms of reference, we can think about Theodore de Beze, who for whom allegiance to the country came before allegiance to the patria, which is a feminine word. And I think the gender codes are very important in the description of political discourse. Now, allegiance to the patria, according to people like this, was... came before allegiance to the father. Now, patriarchalist à la Filmer tried to, by identifying through the Adamite paradigm, king and patria, king and nation, father and fatherland, tried to find an antidote to this idea that filial allegiance came second to allegiance to the patria, to the motherland, because that would have justified precisely the type of murderous actions which people have been writing about, and in some cases taken. Now, to conclude on a kind of again more general issue, the journey that Filmer's Patriarcha allow me to do is a journey which asks once again the reading of text in their pertinent context, but also in the context in which they were published, how they were reread. For a long time it was thought that Filmer, even if published in the 1680, disappeared. But nowadays, courtesy of instruments like Evo, we can actually ascertain in a much quicker way whether claims like that were true or not. And I believe to have proved that they were wrong. Filmer was widely read and criticised up to the Glorious Revolution, proving that patriarchalist discourse was very much at the centre, the forefront of political discourse in that phase. But the other thing which I try to do is to show how it is important to situate political works, and this perhaps is a little bit of a criticism that I address to the scholar whose methodology I follow in my work, and that scholar, sounds a bit like the elephant in the room, is Quentin Skinner. Despite using his work, I did two things contrary to what he does. The first thing, I worked on losers, and minor answer, something that Quentin doesn't do. And the second thing is I looked at how a text can be related to the aesthetic, the cultural, the moral, the intellectual context around it. In other terms, I tried to enforce to gender codes as well. In other terms, looking at patriarchy is not just looking at fear as power, but it's also looking at the idea of fatherhood, which emerges from there, the idea of allegiance, the idea of a masculine power, why is it necessary to use that language at that specific time, and so on and so forth. I hope, and I know that probably what I've done in my work, I'm certainly probably not to Sir Robert Filmer, but I hope that the book will bring, if not together, closer, not just historians of political thoughts or various approaches, but also political historians and also gender and cultural practitioners. Thanks to all.